$500 to our pledge total as soon as we hear from
20
of you. 15 more of you.
15 more, yes.
Okay, I can do it. I can spit it up. You know, I'm just going to give you a few reasons to support WILL besides all the you know, everything else we're talking about. You know, Mike Zusilo, Brian Maple, Pete Manhart, Jackie Vakes, Ellen Dearden, Wayne Nelson. Can I go on? Paul Cooley, Dan Zwicker, Kurt Kimmel, Dave Dickey, Todd Gleason. These are all people that provide you throughout the week with what would it take for you to sit down and call all these people individually and try and assemble all this information? Come on, we do it for you right here, and we don't even send you a bill for a subscription. It's a voluntary thing. So $100, $200, can you do it? Get an ag hat, help us meet the Bates Commodity Challenge, $500 riding on the next 15 calls.
Seven in now.
244-9455, eight to go, 244-9455. Let's do it together.
You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana in the studio, Focus 580. No, that's not right.
Oh, Focus, yes, it is. It host. Sort of is.
Focus host David Inns. Yeah.
It's the same show.
Even better.
Even better. This morning, in the first part of the show, we were scheduled to talk with Barbara King, an anthropologist from College of William and Mary, who was going to be visiting the campus. And unfortunately, she's under the weather, was not able to come, will not be doing the show. But we thought what we could do is reach into our archives and find something that was kind of animal related, because she was here going to be talking about the bond between animals and humans. So we've got an archive we're going to run. We'll be asking people for their support. Hour number two, I want to make sure people know, hour number two, we are back here live, and we will be doing our regular Talk to the Family Doctor show with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician now with the Carl Physician Group. And any questions you may have on health, you can call in there in hour number two. We'll get underway in just a moment.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Knowing Animal Initiative lecture series presents Apes, Elephants, and the Relational Self, Thinking Through Animal Personhood by Barbara King on Monday, April 12th at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum. Online at www.cas.illinois.edu.
And good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, first thing I need to do is tell you that event, which we just promoted there, is not going to be happening. Barbara King was going to be our guest here this morning, and unfortunately she had to postpone her visit to the campus. And so that is canceled. If you want to find out more, go to the website of the Center for Advanced Study, which is cas.illinois.edu. This was in anticipation of what will be an initiative they'll be doing for next year on connections between humans and animals. And I think that what they're going to try to do is have Professor King come in the fall, and if and when she's here, we'll have her here on this program. So we thought what we could do is reach into our archives and find something that also was about the animal-human bond. This is a program we first broadcast in March of 2006, a conversation with Catherine Greer about a book that she wrote entitled Pets in America, which is about the 100-year history of pet keeping in America. So do recall, keep in mind as you listen to the show, that for this first hour of Focus, we will not be taking calls. Surveys tell us that more than 60% of American households have pets. And indeed, if you ask people, pet owners, about their attitudes toward their companion animals, they routinely describe them as their best friends or as family members. In fact, amazingly enough, even 20% of reptile owners describe their pets as being like a child or family member. And when you ask people, you engage them in conversation about, well, is there any downside to having a pet? The things that they mention are not big veterinary bills, not the kind of damage that their animals might cause in the house, but the inevitable fact that one day their pet will die. This morning in this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about how it is that we became such a nation of animal lovers, and about the fact that this is not really a new phenomenon. You can certainly see the roots of contemporary pet ownership going back into the 19th century. And our guest for the program is Catherine Greer. She's the author of a recently published book, which is entitled Pets in America, A History. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press, in which he makes the argument that by looking at this phenomenon, you can actually learn some interesting things about people's at ideas about human nature, about responsibility to others, including animals, about child raising. All of that you can see, actually, and learn some things about by studying this very question about why it is that so many people for such a long time in this country have had this very powerful bond with their companion animals. Our guest, Catherine Greer, is professor of material culture studies at the Winterthur Program in Early American Culture at the Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library and the University of Delaware. She's also the author of another book entitled Culture and Comfort, Parlor Making and Middle Class Identity, 1850 to 1930. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Greer, hello.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We'd certainly appreciate it. I know in a little interview here I had read with you, you described yourself as an historian who studies everyday life.
Yes.
Especially the routines and rhythms of life at home. So that would suggest that this kind of subject might be natural. But the thing that I think is interesting is, as you write in the introduction, how studying this phenomenon, pet ownership, gives you a window into a lot of other things that might, at first blush, seem not particularly related. That's
true.
Is really interesting.
It's true, and it interested me the more I got into it. What I discovered is that pet keeping became a lens for looking at a lot of different issues about American society as it developed in the late 18th and the 19th and early 20th centuries. As you mentioned in your introduction, it gives us a window into ideas about what constitutes good character and how to raise children properly. But it also became part of a much wider debate pretty early on in the 19th century about how do you make a good community and what are our responsibilities to others. And the discussion about animal treatment was embedded in a larger discussion that included all kinds of issues like abolitionism and temperance and even an attack on corporal punishment, the idea of corporal punishment. So it became part of a much larger discussion, and I think that's true today. I think that when you talk to people about pet keeping, that it very rapidly becomes a discussion about much broader issues.
It's also interesting that if you, you know, think about some of the characteristics of pet ownership as they exist now in the year 2006, how people think about their animals, how they live with them, what they do with them, stuff they buy for them.
Yes.
that all of that, it's not a recent sort of phenomenon, and certainly it goes back before World War II. It really even goes back before World War I.
Yes.
A lot of the characteristics of modern pet ownership as we think about it start to fall into place really in the as you get into the last quarter or so of the 19th century.
Yes, that's true. And one of the things when I started the project, one of the things about this project that's been so interesting is that every time I've told anybody what I'm working on, one of the things they've had very strong opinions about it, sometimes for or again, but also they've had very strong ideas about when pet keeping started and what people in America started. And what people have said to me over and over is, nobody did this till after World War II when people had more money to spend. And that just didn't make sense to me, because why would suddenly having more disposable income make you want to take an animal into your household? There's not a direct connection that I could see. So I went back into the historical record and discovered, as I got back into diaries and letters and children's books and magazines, that there was quite a lively community of pet keepers early by the 19th century. And then one of the things that happens is, as American society generally starts to become more and more of a consumer society, all these products start to appear for animals. And commercial pet food is a good example of that. Commercially packaged bird seed was the first commercial pet food, and it was offered for sale by the 1840s. And dog food arrived in America via Britain in the 1870s.
And as you go back and you look, you see right back to the spirit we're talking about, people having dogs, people having cats.
Yes.
Caged birds apparently were very, very popular at one time. That seemed to fall off a little, but people kept songbirds, and sometimes in very wonderful, elaborate cages that you can still see now as preserved as pieces of folk art.
Yes.
So all of that was there in place. People had people kept rabbits. Apparently, that was thought to be things like rabbits and mice were thought to be good children's pets. And even at that time, there was this beginning of this idea that to some extent we still have that for children having that kind of interaction with animals, having a pet, is supposed to be a good thing for their healthy development.
Yes, absolutely. And that actually, the first seeds of that appear in John Locke's, the English philosopher John Locke's work in the 1690s, when he describes what he calls keeping favorite animals as a good thing for children as long as they're not allowed to be abusive to them. So you find evidence of that as early as the 1690s, but what happens by the end, 100 years later, is that parents who are kind of progressive parents and interested in progressive child rearing start to argue that children are these malleable creatures who are not born evil. They have an innate moral sense that needs to be nurtured. And one of the things that you want to do is you want to figure out how to give them responsibility and care for other beings from a very early age. And the best way to practice was to give them pets. So really, by the 1820s and 1830s, a lot of child-rearing advice starts to recommend pet-keeping as something that's a positive good, that parents, animals have been around the house before that, but now they're paying attention to them as not just something that's present and not important. It suddenly becomes something that has some real moral implications.
Hmm. One of the things, just at this point, I wanted to mention, and I have a caller we can get to, something that I think is really wonderful and also tells you something about the way people felt about animals, is that apparently very, very early on in photography, when it got to the point where people had access to photography, that is, they could go someplace and have their picture taken,
yes,
and for not a whole lot of money. What's interesting is that very early on, people started to take their pets to have,
yes,
their pictures taken. And in the book, there are a number of them, really some really wonderful photographs of either people with their animals or just the animal. They took,
yeah,
the animal, they put it on a little chair in front,
yeah,
of the camera, and they took their animals, had their animals photo taken.
It's amazing. I mean, I joke about this and say to people that when photography arrived in America in 1840, 15 minutes after the first studio opened, someone had a dog there.
Mm-hmm.
It really almost seems like there was latent demand, is that people not only were eager for pictures of themselves, but they were eager for pictures of the things they cared about, and dogs were one. And then as soon as the shutter speed, or excuse me, the camera speed and the film speed improved, especially by the 1850s with the tintype, lots of people could bring in cats as well as dogs. So it's really quite astonishing is that they are bringing these animals into the photo studio. Then by the 1880s, when you start to see the beginnings of real snapshot photography, one of the most popular subjects, just like with family photos today, is the pet, is, mm-hmm, having your animal in a photograph, in a snapshot, either with you or by itself, performing tricks or doing the kinds of things it did.
Yeah, they even did memorial photographs, which,
yes,
is something that in the Victorian era people did, well, when they lost a family member.
Yes.
That's something that people now, I think, find a little strange, or some people also find fascinating. The idea is that you, as a memento, if you lost a child or if you lost someone like that, you would have an actual sort of formal portrait taken as a remembrance. And people also did that with their animals. They did that with dogs.
Yes, I have not found dead cat photos yet, but they may be out there. And there are definitely quite a few photos of what we would call posthumous portraits, where a beloved dog has been carried into a photo studio and arranged, and oftentimes the body is arranged so that it doesn't look dead. I mean, they really work hard to make it look like it's just asleep. And the one that I have illustrated in my book is a dog that You know, you'd have to look closely to make sure that it's actually a dead dog, because they have it arranged as a sleeping dog.
Yeah, this is one of those interesting sort of things, Victorian funerary practices that nowadays we think are sort of strange, but were very common at the time. Our guest in this Point of Focus 580, Catherine Greer, and her book is titled Pets in America, A History. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. And we have a caller here. I will not make them wait any longer. We'll get right to them. Champaign is the place, and that's line number one. Hello.
Thank you. As part of your research, I wondered, did you watch or study Errol Morris's first film, The Gates of Heaven?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
I just find it one of the most fascinating examinations of our attitudes about death, but all of it looking from the point of view of this pet cemetery and the people who had their pets buried there, and then even very interesting, the guy whose job was rendering animals to attitudes he had to deal with.
Yes. One of the things I discovered was that, that first of all, the earliest formal burial that I've found of a pet is about in the year 1800. And it's a cat who is discussed in a Philadelphia family as a beloved cat, and they have a formal little funeral for it in their yard. But one of the things that you see is the pet cemetery really comes along as attitudes, people are becoming more and more emotionally invested in pet animals, and because they live in urban places, they no longer have a place where they can bury them. And so the first commercial pet cemetery appears in this country in 1896, and it is still in business today. It's called the Hartsdale Canine Cemetery, and you can visit it in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York, and it's really an extraordinary place. It's full of all kinds of animals, not just dogs. And it is a perpetual care cemetery, so that these gravestones, families invest the money, and they often put multiple burials in the same monument, under the same monument, just as people do with family gravestones today.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Others, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, if you go back to early America, you can find that people had animals in their lives. There was people had livestock, obviously, that were raised for food and also to do work. And people had dogs to do all those jobs that dogs do. They're for hunting, I'm sure, for hunting, for herding, for guarding, those traditional roles of dogs. And I'm sure at some point people also would have at least lived with cats or encouraged them to be around because they go after stored grain pests. And, you know, that's an important – they actually had an important function there. So people, their attitudes, I would think a lot of their attitudes towards many of these animals would be maybe primarily utilitarian, although I think I would expect that people also would have feelings about them too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sort of wondering, where – is there some sort of point, or is it sort of a gray point where you see – more of a kind of transition from people's attitudes and experiences mostly being like that and valuing animals for their function, either for food or for work, to this point where you start to think more about the animal's function as being the kind of companionship that they can provide. And how does it, and there must certainly have been a time when people could have, you know, people had sort of had both those attitudes. I mean, you still do, you know, they're... There are, I'm sure there are plenty of people who eat meat and who have companion animals. That's not necessarily mutually exclusive. But, you know, is there some point where you see something interesting in that transition between sort of the one attitude to the other?
Well, one of the things I was struck by was actually it's a more gradual process than I had thought when I started the research. And that people, you know, nowadays we say, well, people have pets because they don't know anything about livestock, and you know, they don't take care of animals for utilitarian reasons. But one of the things that I found out was that people in the past just did both things. That they had no difficulty sort of saying that human purposes were transcendently important. You know, there's a little more ambivalence about that today, at least in some segments of the population. And what they said at the time was, look, you know, man is at the top of this chain of being. it's our responsibility to treat animals well, but in fact, some animals have a function that, you know, we can't live without this function. And so it's our obligation to treat them well prior to the time that we are compelled to use their bodies or treat them well while they do work for us. And it may be that one of the really important transitional points is around the 19-teens and 20s, when the urban workhorse really disappears quickly from cities as automobiles and trucks come along. Because up to that point, even in cities, if you did not have, you know, a cow or chickens, and lots of urban people did, actually, that you saw working animals every day of your life because you saw them. They were they pulled wagons and they were the light trucks of their day, and that transition away from the urban workhorse happens very quickly. It happens really in the 19-teens and 20s, and at that point, I think for urban people, a really important link with working animals is gone forever. They no longer see them on the streets. They don't see them as workers in their communities, and at that point, I think that because people don't have that ongoing contact with working animals, the way they think about animals generally probably starts to shift a little bit.
You're listening to an archive of Focus. This is a program that we first ran in March of 2006. The guest is Catherine Greer, and we were talking about her book, Pets in America. And what it is a history of the relationship between people and their companion animals in America over the last about 100 years. We were going to be talking this morning with Barbara King, an anthropologist from College of William and Mary. She was coming to the campus to give a talk about the animal-human bond, and she unfortunately had to cancel her visit. This was a program that was going to be anticipating an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study that they'll be doing next year, looking at the animal-human bond. And they hope that she will be here on the campus in the fall and we can have her on the program then. More information is available at the CAS website, which is www.cas.illinois.edu. But we thought that if we ran an archive here, it also would give us an opportunity to talk a little bit about archives and podcasts, which is a feature that we have had here on the station for a few years at least. And what we think is really exciting about this is that it is another way for people to listen to the programs. Jack Brighton is here in studio with me. He's our internet director, and also Kimberly Cronick, who's our director of community engagement. And I just thought I would ask Jack to come in for a couple of minutes, and maybe you could talk about a little bit about how it is we went from hardly having internet presence at all to now this being a really important way for people to get the programming.
Right. We've been offering archives of Focus 580 in the afternoon magazine and news programs and our agricultural services and various other things since really 1998 is when we first started doing that. So think about that. You know, 12 years now. There are a lot of archives on our website. Every single show that we produce here locally is on our website as streaming audio, and you can download an MP3 file or you can get a podcast if you are one of the people who does podcasts. So every show is freely available on our website, and you can actually browse by date, by category, by topic. You can do a search. You can find things. And we know that many of you out there do use this. In fact, we get something like 900,000 MP3 downloads per month from our website. So we know a lot of people are consuming these archives, and we want to make them as accessible as possible. So we work really hard to sort of catalog everything and organize it in a way that people can find things. So, you know, we feel pretty strong that that's one of our duties here. You know, we're doing all these great shows, you know, and Focus has been on the air. Do you realize, David, almost 30 years?
Yes. Yes, I do realize that. If we all make it to next year, we could celebrate the 30th anniversary of the show. And it's something that I'm particularly proud of having been involved with for a long time, that I think, you know, every show, it's not a home run, but I think if you look at the totality of what we've done, we've managed to do an awful lot of interviews at a pretty high level every, you know, 10 times every week. So that's a lot.
And if, excuse me. And I hope that that's something we're supporting for you, that you would call us right now at 217-244-9455 and make a pledge to WILL during Focus. We have a goal of 1,000 supporters during this drive, which began just on Saturday. We are more than a quarter of the way there, so that's good news. But we can only do it one pledge at a time. Please call right now with your pledge at 217-244-9455. Or you can go online and pledge at willpledge.org. One of the things I like about this show is that it takes an everyday experience and it peels back the personal and puts it in a larger context, which is what you do all the time on the show. And I think that's why people like myself and others listen to the program. So, you know, you can go online, you can listen now, you can count on that kind of analysis. It's also from an international perspective, but it also all the way to a local perspective. What's going on in our communities locally? How can our programs connect you to information for you to take action? We think that's worth supporting. We'd like you to say you agree by making a pledge at 217-244-9455.
Yeah. Lately we have dropped the 580 out of the name of the show, which is something I have a hard time with because I've only been saying Focus 580 for 30 years.
Right.
And maybe people are wondering, well, what's that about? Well, back when we started doing the program, we thought it was important to remind people what station they were listening to. So that's why 580 is in the name, because it was on AM 580. But now, it's not just AM 580. You could be listening to the podcast. You could be listening online. You could be listening on the FM HD. And we think that what's really exciting about that is opening up and creating new ways for people to get the show.
And there are going to be more and more new ways for people to get the show. I mean, this is one thing that the internet is teaching us, is that people are finding programs and content and things of value in all kinds of ways and using them in all kinds of ways. So, you know, we're trying to be as flexible as possible, and perhaps the name change reflects that. I wanted to also just kind of amplify a little bit on the work of doing this archival kind of activity. We feel that public broadcasting, public media, has a unique role in this, and we have a unique opportunity to make knowledge available to people, like Focus 580, Focus, I should say, all the news stuff, all the other things, the increasing amount of video that we're putting on our website that really reveals the world. This is the audiovisual record of the past 50 years is the most deep and rich archive of our times, and so we're trying to really be very effective in making that available. A lot of the stuff that, in fact, everything going on the website now in terms of the audio archives is all automatic. So, you know, I set up a way to do that without a human being having to produce every archive. But, you know, we're also going back and getting tapes off the shelves and doing the real manual work to bring back those 30 years of Focus and putting them on the website. And so that work continues. We don't have all 30 years on the website, and we probably never will because we probably don't have all the tapes. But those that we do, we are going to revive and make accessible.
All right. So once again, we really want to remind people that they are supporting this show, all their programs they hear on this station, but in fact this really larger effort to try and make this kind of information and this content widely available for everybody. And we should also mention that, you know, when you go to the website, you want to listen to something, you sign up for the podcast, there's no charge for that. We don't say, okay, you want to hear the show? That'll be 99 cents.
Right.
No, we don't do that.
This is not iTunes.
This is not iTunes.
And 40% of our operating fund comes from you, the listener, who makes a pledge. So it's so important that you call right now at 217-244-9455. I mean, that's why we're here. We don't have a lot of time. We don't come very often to you and ask you directly to contribute while you're listening to the program. But today, I'm sorry, today is one of those times. So please call in now. We want to hear from 1,000 people who make pledges by the 17th. We're over a quarter of the way there, which is good news. Basic membership pledge is just $40. Go online, willpledge.org, or call right now, 217-244-9455. I know we're going to go back in just a moment to Pets in America. You won't want to miss any of that. So call right now, 217-244-9455.
Or if you want, you can go to willpledge.org and pledge online.
You can listen to an archive and pledge at the same time.
All right. Well, thanks very much. What we want to do is, again, return to the interview that we have been airing this morning. This is an archive presentation of Focus, a show we first broadcast in March of 2006. It is a conversation with Catherine Greer, author of the book Pets in America. Talk about the fact that nowadays, if you ask people who have companion animals, and the fact that we start to – we use that phrase now tells you something – that they have these animals in their lives, you ask them about them, you see that people do indeed have an important emotional bond,
yes,
and that people do talk about them and think about them as family members. And I think that also there's some evidence to show that there actually can be benefits to having a companion animal around. And, you know, now we have animals that go visiting in nursing homes, and we have animals that go visit sick kids in the hospital. And that seems actually to be very beneficial. Some people, though, I suppose, don't understand that. And some people might, in fact, say they think it's sort of odd that for some people, companion animals could almost function as surrogate children.
Yeah.
What I'm wondering is whether, if you look back, whether you could find people saying those same kinds of things the past.
Absolutely. One of the things that's so funny about doing this, recovering this sort of this historical discussion about the place of animals, especially companion animals or pets in the household, is that you hear the same arguments for and against over and over and over and over a very long period of time. You'll see people in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, you'll see writers saying, boy, these lap dogs, it's a disgrace the way people carry these little lap dogs around and the way women are foolish over these dogs, and it's a real disgrace. They should be paying attention to running their households and taking care of their children. Well, the discussion that you're hearing right now about the current craze for small lap dogs has some elements that sound very much like that. So one of the difficult and interesting things as a historian is figuring out when you see the same discussion occurring over and over and over periodically in the historic record, what does it mean? And I'm not sure that I have an answer for that exactly. It's that, you know, certain things are different. There's certainly a difference between a 19th century woman with a lap dog and Paris Hilton and her chihuahua, but you know that the same issues, the same discussions come up repeatedly in the historic record. And I think one of the things it does is it suggests that there is no single answer for this discussion, that there have been people around for a long time who find contact with animals unpleasant or mysterious, that they don't have sort of a natural, any kind of desire to engage in that. And then you find people in the historical record who are fascinated from the time that they're children. And that, sometimes I think it almost comes down to a matter of temperament. It's sort of hard to say what makes one family like another or different from another in that regard.
Mm. Well, certainly the thing that strikes me is that the an animal as a fashion accessory is not new, and that wealthy people probably have been doing that for a long time, and then we would get to a point where it also would have been possible for middle-class people
to do the same thing,
and maybe indeed that was inspired by the fact that wealthy people did that, and having certain kinds of animals would have been a marker of your status, your social status.
Very true, especially with purebred dogs, is that American dogs in most of the 19th century and into the 20th century didn't look, as a population, they didn't look like the population of dogs you see today. There were sort of some basic types, sort of a bulldog type and a terrier type and a spaniel type, but the range of breeds that you see today just did not exist. And what happens when what's called the dog fancy arrives in this country in the last quarter of the 19th century, and it really introduces dogs as status symbols in more significant numbers than ever before. For one thing, you have dogs that, like dachshunds and poodles and things like that, are being imported from Europe, so they have a little bit of cachet that way. And then their rarity, sometimes their fragility, their small size, all the expense involved in obtaining them, all these things kind of add up to the dog as a status symbol, which is something that is well in place by the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm. Well, that did interest me, that particularly interest in certain kinds of breeds, or the fact that from time to time a particular kind of breed seems to enjoy a lot of popularity.
Yes.
And you see it in illustrations, and people seem to want to have them. That's not new either. That goes back before 1900.
I know, and you find these fads for dogs. In the mid-19th century, there was a fad, although I don't know how many people actually owned them because we don't have good numbers, but there was a fad for Italian greyhounds, those tiny little greyhounds. And then in the 1870s and 80s, there was a fad for pugs. And the pug was an extremely popular and fashionable dog breed to have, and they show up in a lot of photographs. People, once they had a pug, they dressed them up in a fancy collar, and then they took them off to the photographer's studio, and there's some wonderful images of these sort of grumpy-looking pugs. And then there's others that come along. In the early 20th century, the dog that became enormously popular and stayed that way for decades and decades was the Boston Terrier. And what's interesting about that is that that is an American breed. That dog was, that breed of dog was created in America by crossing a number of different bulldog and terrier types and creating this little spiffy-looking black and white dog whose original function was actually as a fighting dog. Hmm. And then they breed it down in size, and it really becomes a companion dog. But it was also the object of a fad in the early 20th century.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint. We have some other callers we will get to in just a moment here as soon as I introduce again the guest. Catherine Greer is professor of material culture studies at the Winterthur Program in Early American Culture, Winterthur Museum, Garden and Library, and the University of Delaware. And she's the author of a very interesting book recently published. It's titled Pets in America, A History, and it's published by the University of North Carolina Press. We have some other folks to talk with here. Next up is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. Mm-hmm. Well, what a great subject, because it's our relationship with animals, especially, as you say, pets, because that word itself implies an emotional attachment versus a practical attachment. About 30 years ago, I was doing a photography shoot out in the country. Taken for weird, I just picked the subject of cows, and this guy was one of the farmers, I guess the farmer that owned him, or came by, and he said, hey, I'll call him over. So he yelled something at him, and they all sort of walked over, and they were, you know, licking my hand and stuff. And, and he goes, you know, I said, hey, they seem to know your voice. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, I kind of hate taking them to the slaughterhouse. And I thought, you know, but it was weird because he had this, they would come up and lick his hand and stuff. And, and but he almost like he thought of them as not, well, he knew what they were product, but it was just very interesting. I always remember that. I mean, all these years later, I remember that. But, yeah, I was this interesting subject because how people look at pets. I mean, people I know, and I don't have a pet. I haven't had a pet since I left my parents' house. I've never owned one on my own. But it's interesting to see all my friends that have had pets over the years and how they put so much of their emotional energy into them. And, you know, even though they have children and stuff, but, I mean, it's a very, very interesting subject. And
well, there's a couple things, let me say, in response to that. One of the things that I sometimes hear from people is these people like animals and they don't like people.
Yeah.
And what I've found is that except on sort of the far end where you may have people who are animal hoarders or have a real social pathology of some type, that who says that love is a finite quantity, right, and that there is, you can't have more and more of it to spread around. So what you often find is that pet owners are also people. They really like other people. They love children. That it seems to be part of a sort of a broader embracing of life and all its variety. And so, you know, I've tended to sort of say, now you need to rethink that just because people love animals doesn't mean that they don't love people too.
Yeah, they're not all not PETA people.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's an interesting subject, but I mean, our relationship with animals is just so fascinating. I just want to say one thing about
hanging. Sure.
There was a book written, about a 1,000-page book written about the history of the continent of Africa, and the writer, some historian, he covered her from the Geological Forum. But during the process of that book, he said something very strange. He goes, and these animals, he was talking about cattle and stuff, allowed themselves to be made domestic. And I thought, like as if they said, okay, it's easier for me to work with these people, you know, bipeds or whatever. But I always thought that kind of struck me, too, as an odd thing. But
I know.
Great subject. I mean, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, bye.
Thanks for your interest.
Yeah. Before I go on to another call real quick, I think it's interesting to look at the development of the word pet.
Yeah.
Because when it starts out, it was not coined to describe an animal. It was just coined to describe another person. When you sit to call someone your pet, you know, that was a term of endearment that you would apply to another person. And I guess it was sometime after that then people started to call the animals in their lives their pets.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. Before that, in the 18th century, what you find is people using the term favorite, and they'll say, my favorite dog, my favorite rabbit. And that's the word they use instead of pet. And pet tended to be used to be applied to, oh, particularly a kind of a spoiled child or a person that you had a love relationship with. So then it kind of makes a transition over to a discussion of animals.
Well, let's talk with a caller in, let's see, Champaign here, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I was just interested. This is a topic near and dear to my heart, and I finally realized you were talking about the history of America.
Yes.
And I think maybe it should be amended, the history of European America, because I haven't heard you talk about natives, and I wonder if they kept pets. And I would
question.
Like you to, you know, you've started to acknowledge that this isn't modern. The ancient Egyptians worshipped cats. I don't know if you define pet as keeping animals that you love or keeping animals that have no other usefulness. And that would be where the luxury item comes in, is to be able to afford to keep an animal that doesn't bring you any other purpose or
right.
service. But, you know, and they talked about, even the Bible talks about God creating the animals as helpers and companions for man. So
yes.
I'd say this is way before we even can recall history. So
that's absolutely true. We know from archaeology that dogs were present and living in close proximity to people at least 12,000 years ago, and some people say much longer. So they've been around for a long time. Regarding indigenous peoples or Native Americans, one of the things that you find is, well, there's a difference between North and South America. In South American indigenous groups, for example, there is a pretty considerable, in places like Mexico, a pretty considerable tradition of bird keeping. And there are small clay objects that are birds in cages. So they were part of, that clearly was a practice in South America prior to culture contact with Europeans. In the case of North America, what you find is that Native Americans had very interesting and complex relationships to dogs. Dogs were spiritual guides. Dogs were beasts of burden. Dogs were companions. They were hunters. Dogs were used as babysitters for children. So they really served a whole array of uses, and some of those kind of bled over into just dogs being present and being kind of companions, and some, I think, were clearly what we would consider pets in a modern sense, but others were workers.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I think we talked a little bit earlier about, particularly if you go back and you look at the kind of animals people had, there was a time when caged birds were extremely popular, particularly
yes.
birds that would sing. I guess that
yes.
that was the idea. And that maybe one of the things that happened to the caged songbird that made it less popular, people became less interested, was the coming of recorded music and of the radio. And that was one of the reasons that people had them, was for the pleasantness of having them sing. And
yeah.
once you could turn the radio on and have music, people didn't seem to be quite as interested in having caged birds anymore.
Yeah, I found that fascinating because birds, European Americans brought bird keeping to North America as pets. And it's we just don't think about how quiet the world was, how silent households were, that if you didn't make your own music, there was none to be had, and that women working alone in a household things were very quiet, they could be quite lonely. And I'm sort of struck by the efforts that people made to carry birds with them, even on the trek west. There's a group of wonderful photographs of soddies and pioneer homesteads in Nebraska that was taken in the 1880s by a guy named Solomon Butcher. And if you get a chance to look at a group of those photos, you'll see that there are bird cages hanging in a lot of the soddies, that people have gone to the trouble of carrying cages and bringing caged birds with them. And I think it was just because the days were so silent, it was a form of company.
Hmm. Well, let's talk again with someone else. The next caller is someone in Urbana in line three. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I heard you use the term pet hoarding, and I had never run across that word, that phrase, until maybe a year or so now. And I have a friend who is crazy about pets. She's a general hoarder, and she always likes to have four dogs and like about 10 cats always in her household. And she is a hoarder of other, you know, of other things. And so I wondered, you know, would this constitute pet hoarding? And could you explain what pet hoarding is?
Well, pet hoarding is has been a topic of interest in the animal welfare community for quite a while. And there's a veterinarian named Gary Petronik at Tufts University at the veterinary school who has worked on the issue of animal hoarding or pet hoarding. It has been argued that it is related to obsessive-compulsive disorder, or that it is...
hoarding is an OC problem.
Yes, that it can be an OC problem. And one of the issues that identifies true hoarding, pet hoarding, from an instance where you have somebody who just keeps an awful lot of animals...
And loves them,
has to do with the level of care that they get. What happens with hoarders is, tends to happen with hoarders, is that they are eventually overwhelmed by this continuing introduction of more and more animals into the household, and the living conditions of both the people and the animals decline considerably. And periodically, you'll see something in a local newspaper where a shelter group has gone into a household and to a small apartment even and removed 20 or 30 cats or dogs. In pretty miserable conditions, and that is kind of classic hoarding.
I see. Oh, no, she takes extremely good care of her pets, good care.
And I don't think it's a problem. I think that unless, you know, she's violating some kind of municipal code city gets on her.
She has a big house, you know, and that's why she got a big house.
Well, I'm inclined to say that, you know, whether she is shading into true animal hoarding, I can't say, not seeing the case, but I would venture to say that this doesn't sound like the true animal hoarding that it has been a concern to animal welfare groups.
Okay, so animal hoarding is really a pejorative term?
It is used as a pejorative term or to identify, I wouldn't say pejorative, but to identify something that can be considered a social pathology.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up.
I would rather call your friend an enthusiastic pet keeper.
She is. She just adores her. She had a diabetic cat. My goodness, she took such good care of it.
Well, that's not hoarding.
No. No.
All right, we're going to have to jump out of the program right here. You've been listening to a show from the Focus Archives, a conversation with Catherine Greer, author of the book Pets in America. We first ran the show in March of 2006. We weren't able to do the show we had planned for this morning, but we wanted to stick with that theme of animal-human bond, and so we reached back to our archive to pick the show. We could have picked just about anything because we have a very deep archive, years and years worth of shows that are available for you anytime you like. But this is another service that we provide to listeners, having the archives there, and it's made possible by listeners. That's why it's really important during this spring fundraising effort that people who listen to the station and have listened to Focus on the other shows also are supporters. You can do that very easily right now by picking up your telephone, not calling into the show like you might ordinarily, but calling the pledge number, which is 217-244-9455, and making a financial contribution to help pay for the programs that you value. Kimberly Cronick is here in studio with me. She is our Director of Community Engagement.
Hey, David, it's good to be with you and listening to this program. I have a perfect soundbite, a quote from a listener who pledged to WILL. It's relevant to your call right now, your program. He writes, "I listen all the time. In fact, after listening to WILL for 3 years during graduate school, I continued to listen online after I moved to a different state. Now I'm back, and not only do I listen all the time, but my dog Milkshake listens to WILL while he's in his kennel when no one is home. WILL makes my life better and his life better, and I'm sorry I haven't donated before." So isn't that wonderful? Here, he and his dog listen. He has now become a first-time contributor to WILL. He called 217-244-9455. Do like him and call in now or make a pledge, willpledge.org. We are in our fund drive, and we need to hear from 1,000 listeners who become members by making a financial contribution. $40 is our basic membership. It's real important to do that now because 40% of our operating funds come from you, the listener. We are about a quarter of a way toward our goal of 1,000 pledges during this drive. And David, you know, programs like PETS, programs like the one coming up where we talk about family health with a doctor, you can call in and get information right away. Programs that put our world into perspective, all the way from internationally down to the local level, are reasons why I keep listening and why I'm a member as well as a worker here at WILL. So give a call, 217-244-9455.
Yeah. We want to say thanks to people, and there are some people who have supported us for a long, long time. The organization that we call the Friends of WILL, our financial supporters, has been around since 1974. And during that time, certainly there have been ups and downs, and we have faced challenges, but I'm not sure that we have faced anything like the kind of challenge we're facing right now. We're really in a financial crisis. All of us, the nation, is in a financial crisis, and clearly the state of Illinois is too. It affects the university, and that affects us. We are able to continue to do our work very clearly because of the continued support and generosity of listeners. That is the bottom line. And for people who have contributed, we want to say thanks. And maybe for whatever reason, you're a listener but not a contributor, this would be a really great time for you to join in the Friends of WILL.
And we have already had three people call in and make pledges during this hour of focus. We thank you so much for that. That's got our total up to 48 pledges for the day, and that's great. We want to double that number for sure. I also want to just remind you that basic membership is $40. You can pledge two ways, 217-244-9455 right now. Get it out of the way or go online, willpledge.org. Let me give you one more soundbite from a listener who made a pledge. He says, public radio and the news commentary, it provides me hope for society. Sometimes it surprises me. Sometimes it makes me sad, but at least it's engaging me and challenging assumptions, not just trying to fatten me up, distract me, and sell me things. Keep it up, he says, and that's why he pledged. I think that's a great reason.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here, as we usually do at this point. And as Kim mentioned, in the second hour, Dr. Jeff Swearingen will be here. He's a family practice doctor here in our area. Every other month, he's on the program, and we do the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is whatever kind of questions people have about health, he sees people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups, kids. You're welcome to call in and ask your questions. That'll be coming up in just a couple of minutes.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the University Library's 2010 Big Read Project, celebrating Sun, Stone, and Shadows, 20 great Mexican short stories, with a special lecture by Luis Urrea at the Champaign Public Library April 18th. More information at bigreadillinois.org.
And as I mentioned, coming up in the next part of the show, Dr. Jeff Swearingen will be here to take questions. Over the years, we have tried to do a number of different kinds of programs here under the Focus umbrella, and one of those is that show that we do with Dr. Jeff. And the idea is that, you know, you got a healthcare question, you can call us. We have other physicians on the show. We have some people who are financial advisors. We have people to talk about nutrition and computers and cars, whatever. We've tried to make the show useful to people, and we hope that it will engage them mentally, but also shows like that when the idea is, you know, you got a question, call in, and the guests will do their best to help you.
Yeah,
out.
It's kind of like you don't have to go to the clinic or call your doctor to make an appointment. You can sometimes get those answers right here by calling in during this program. And we want you to call in right now and make a pledge so you don't miss any of that information that's coming up in your chance to call in. Call right now and pledge at 217-244-9455 or go to our website, willpledge.org. I mean, we take the time to get experts in this field, people who are credible, people who have a long history, people you trust, and we bring them to you over the airwaves. It's a great service, and let us know that you appreciate it by calling right now, 217-244-9455.
And right now we have an update on the markets.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right out to the exchanges in Kansas City. May wheat's now trading at 483, down a half. July, 497, up 2 3/4. September, 510 1/2,
right?
Up 4. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade set 470, up 4 1/4. July, 480 1/2, up 1 1/4. September at 501 1/4, up 4 3/4. May corn, 347, up 1 1/4. July, 358 1/4, up 1. December, 379 1/2, up 3/4. May beans, 957 1/2, up 5 1/4. July, 964, up 2. November, 934, down 2 1/2. May soybean meal, 268.20, up 290. May soybean oil, 39.86, down 18. April live cattle, 99.27 1/2, down 37 1/2.